Hello everyone, welcome to the Trinity Term sessions of the Israeli Studies Seminar. We are excited to have you for Trinity Term. This term, I'll start with a few words. We'll have four meetings, weeks 1 to 4. I find them very interesting and exciting, and you're more than welcome to join us. Our first contributor to our seminar is Dr. Ferit Belder. Ferit is an assistant professor in the Department of International Relations at Marmara University in Istanbul. He earned his MSc's from SOAS, University of London, in 2016 and completed his PhD in Istanbul University in 2018. His doctoral research analyzed the political behavior of ultra-Orthodox political parties in Israel through the framework of societal security. His academic expertise focuses on Israeli politics, including elections and political parties, identity security relationship, Israel-Palestine relations, and Jewish settlements. He is currently conducting his postdoctoral research titled Identifying Multiple Frames of the Israeli Settlements at our own Oxford School of Global and Area Studies. And Ferit, the floor is yours. I'll just say it's recorded. So,
behave yourselves.
Yeah, behave. Please behave. Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me today. My talk will be on the Israeli far right, and I will be questioning the discursive directions of the far right alliance to election periods of 2021 and 2022. When I say Israel far right, I mean the special partnership between two parties, Religious Zionism Party and the Jewish Power Party, Otzma Yehudit. And the smaller fraction within this alliance, Avi Maus and his Noam Party, is not included in this research. I had two objectives doing this research. The first is to see how strategic and ideological directions of the discourse was shaped by the leaders of these two parties, Betzalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir, and which one, for example, was more influential in shaping the general framework of discourse, what were the topics of overlappings, and how did they frame the similar topics, to what extent similar, to what extent different. The second objective was to see if there was a discursive shift between these two election periods in terms of rhetorical strategies, thematic priorities, and ideological framings. But before I start, I should clarify at least three potential setbacks in doing this kind of research. The first is the history dimension, because the historical background of the relationship between religious Zionism and Kahanism as ideologies or as ones is not, it's out of the scope of this research. Actually, it would be illustrative to see the political trajectories of these two movements before the establishment of the partnership. I do that, but I'm not suggesting that this partnership was, this was a natural partnership arising from the historical evolution of the relationship between these two ideologies. Instead, it was the response to the exceptional political circumstances took place after 2019 elections, because there was a coalition crisis. It went to the polls 5 times in 4 years, and this partnership was the result of, was encouraged by himself to mobilize all right-wing voters. And more importantly, religious Zionism movement cannot be limited to Smotrich and his religious Zionist party, because there are different streams within religious Zionism movement, different institutions, figures. So it sounds a bit awkward, but religious Zionism does not represent the entire religious Zionism movement. So I concentrated on the special partnership between two parties. And the second setback, I think, is also related to the first one, is the character of this partnership. To what extent can we take it for granted, especially by considering the current Israeli political developments service, for example, taking two actors as separate entities when asking the respondents, or these actors are rivals as well, because they share certain certain social and political values. They appeal to certain segments of the society, so they are competing with each other to gain the support of those people. So, but what is for certain was that they ran together two times, and I think this special partnership deserves to be analyzed. And the third setback is the term, the far-right discourse itself. The way it is used in my talk does not refer to a monolithic or a unified entity. Instead, it encompasses the collective discourses of both leaders, The discourse of Bezalel Smotrich as the leader and the vocal representative of the Religious Zionism Party, plus the discourse of Itamar Ben-Gvir as the vocal representative of Otzma Yehudit. But rather than being a challenge, it's also an advantage, because it enabled me to see the consensual and conflictual elements within the alliance, to see how they frame similar topics in different ways. Let me say a few words about methodology, because the objective is to map the discursive directions of the far-right alliance. I collected written and visual materials released by these two leaders during the election campaign periods. I collected textual materials, posters, memes, images, pictures, short videos. I collected almost all materials that shared online. And my primary source of data was the X platform, formerly Twitter. And to a lesser extent, I collected data from Facebook not to miss the external context. So my primary source of data was the X platform. And because since I concentrated on the construction of the discourse, the public reception of this discourse, or the reproduction of discourse through dissemination processes, are both outside of the scope of this research. That's why I didn't trace the comments on these platforms or other online communication channels like WhatsApp and Telegram groups. And after collecting data, an inductive and manual coding was applied. Two runs of coding were conducted using MixQDA software. And the first round of coding gave me the chance to create the general framework of the far-right alliance, the general framework of the discourse. And the second round of coding provided an in-depth analysis focusing on three key aspects. Coding phrases to identify the dominant themes within the discourse, co-occurrences to explore how certain are elaborated in relation to others, and intersection between actors to examine how different actors frame specific topics. And I didn't use machine learning techniques like natural processions, because the amount of data was manageable and I had the purpose of not missing the external context. Lastly, I should say a few words on the data collection periods. As I said, I concentrated on the last two election periods, despite there were five consecutive elections between 2019 and 2022. But of course, it's a deliberate strategy, because there was no such partnership in the first election of 2019 and 2020. And during the first election trio, Kahanist voices were viewed as legitimate actors, were not viewed legitimate partners, even among their potential partners. Otzma Yehudit joined the Union of Right-Wing Parties ahead of April 2019 elections. But when the Supreme Court barred the leader of Otzma Yehudit, Mihai Nari, from running in the elections, the Union did not nominate another Otzma Yehudit representative. So it was one of the reasons why Otzma Yehudit left the Union. Then in the second and third elections, religious Zionist leaders like Smotrich, Bezalel Smotrich, Naftali Bennett, Ayelet Shaked, Rafi Peres, they came together to run under the name Yamina. So this cooperation further marginalized Otzma Yehudit leaders. So this corporation kept Otman Yehudi outside of the legitimate circle of politics. The second big difference, I think, between the two sets of elections, I mean the first election trio and the last two elections, is the shift in the Arab politics. Because when the coalition building, the coalition crisis reached its peak in the year 2020, Arab parties had a great performance in terms of cooperation. They ran together, they gained 15 seats in the 120-seat parliament. So when considering the necessity of obtaining 61 seats for coalition and the traditional exclusion role of the Arab parties, it becomes clear how this Arab list as an outsider put the pressure on the circle of coalition building process. So I think this external position was one of the structural factors that might be useful to explain the coalition building crisis Israel experienced. So ahead of 2021 elections, the Arab bloc was also dissolved and Arab Round Party ran independently. And after the elections, it joined the anti-Netanyahu coalition. So it was, I call this circle, this exclusion as the legitimate circle of coalition building to indicate the exclusion of Arab parties. So the Rams joining the coalition marked as the end of this legitimate circle of coalition. So when we look at the general dynamics of the second set of elections, we see the erosion of legitimate politics in two opposite directions. With the inclusion of a minority party, it eroded progressively. With the normalization of Kahane's voices, it eroded more radically. Why I'm putting so much emphasis on legitimacy? Because it's one of the central components of the far-right alliance, this far-right alliance, because of the legitimacy deficit of the Otman Yehudi party. After the first round of voting, the general framework of the discursive map of the far-right alliance emerged, and the general discourse was shaped by two main components. The first is the relationship between the legal political establishment. The second is self-positioning in Israeli political landscape. And the legitimacy seeking was performed right here in this second pillar. Legal political establishment has four main components. Two are related to the reinterpretation of sovereignty, the other two are related to reinterpretation of law. Regarding sovereignty, the alliance called for action in widening and deepening Israeli sovereignty, expanding settlements in the West Bank, and increasing state control over territories where Arab population concerns the right-wing actors like the Negev, Galilee, mixed Arab-Jewish cities of Israel, and Jerusalem. So widening sovereignty beyond the Green Line, deepening sovereignty within the Green Line. And all this happened with no reference to Green Line. Because in the far-right discourse, there's no such thing as a Green Line. So the erosion of Green Line through the normalization of a settlement has long been adopted by religious Zionist actors such as Smotrich. He proudly said that he's seeking to normalize settlements administratively, politically, economically. And he says it's important to expand Israeli sovereignty without declaration. So he refers this process as the gradual process of sovereignty, and it's based on the idea of changing facts on the ground. And according to this logic, one day will come and then Israel will have to expand, and Israeli government will have to expand its sovereignty over territories, and the international community will have to recognize the realities on the ground, will not have an option to turn a blind eye on the realities. Actually, this strategy, one example of this strategy can be seen in the settlement actors' comments on the Trump plan. When the deal of the century was announced, it was criticized by pro-settlement actors because it was envisioning the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. But at the same time, it was viewed as the success of this strategy because Trump plan recognizes the Israeli sovereignty over settlements. And the recent example of this normalization was when Bezalel Smotrich joined the coalition after 2022 elections. He held the ministerial position within the defense ministry with some authority over civil affairs of the civil administration, which oversees the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. So one of the first things he did was to transfer the responsibility of illegal settlement or unauthorized settlements to the governmental ministry. Because according to far-right or according to Bezalel Smotrich's discourse, there is no such thing as a settlement. There are young settlements to be regularized over time, and the state, the government ministry, must be responsible to support this process, to facilitate this regularization process. So it's an example of normalization. But it's important to note here that none of these things, none of these costs were invented by Smotrich or Ben-Gvir. Similar to the topic of settlements, the situation in the Negev is not entirely independent from the state's position. Since the end of the military regime applied to Arab citizens in 1966, the relationship between the Bedouin communities and the state has been marked by controversy surrounding on the demographic control over territories. And the claim of the lack of governance or the lack of sovereignty were already articulated by other right-wing actors like Ariel Sharon. In the year 2000, Ariel Sharon was complaining about the lack of governance in the Negev. Or in the same year, he paid a controversial visit to the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa, to show the Israeli sovereignty over the holy place. But what is different, I think, is the discursive articulation of sovereignty within the religious nationalist context in the example of the far-right discourse. While problematizing the lack of governance in the Negev, they are putting forward the Jewish identity of the victims and calling for action to ensure the security of the Jewish souls. And when opposing the Al-Aqsa status quo, Ben-Gvir portrays the sign of weakness of the Jewish sovereignty in the Jewish holy place. In one of his posts, he says, "The Jewish sovereignty starts on the Temple Mount, and the time has come to exercise sovereignty in the holiest place for the Jewish people." Because for him, it's one of the few places, perhaps the most remarkable one, where Palestinians perform some sort of sovereignty, which is ontologically unacceptable. Or during the Sheikh Jarrah conflicts, he said, "Otzma Yehudit in government will ensure that we will be landlords here in Jerusalem and the rest of the state of Israel." So this was not only the call for the Jewish sovereignty, because Israel already applied, extended its sovereignty over Jerusalem or annexed its Jerusalem, but he calls for de facto sovereignty. That's why it's one of the most striking election slogans of the party in the 2022 elections was, "It's time to be landlord here," or "It's time to show who is landlord here." Similar to sovereignty, the reinterpretation of law obscured two major demands. The first is the call for judicial reform. It aims to reduce the perceived excessive powers of Bagats, the Supreme Court, and to prevent its interventions into politics. Among the right-wing circle, this call was also not something new. And religious Zionist parties and Kahanist actors also the ones who experienced these interventionist interventions of the Supreme Court. That's why they became vocal supporters of this judicial reform. As we mentioned in the example of Mihail Ben-Ari, and he was not the only one, some other figures of Otzma Yehudit party were barred from running in the elections by the Supreme Court. So if Otzma Yehudit had the legitimacy deficit, the legal system is an important aspect to explain this, and Bagatz is at the center of this legal system. So ahead of 2021 elections, they already declared their own judicial reform plan. if they enter to be implemented if they entered into the coalition. So both parties adopted a hawkish stance against the Supreme Court and the current judicial system. And when they joined the coalition after 2022 elections, they were the ones who put pressure on Netanyahu not to step back or negotiate with the opponents. And Ben-Gvir, for example, in the middle of the political crisis, threatened Netanyahu if he opposes the reform. But the second major demand is more radical. I define it as ethno-national reinterpretation of law or selective application of law. Different from judicial overhaul, this call includes radical punishment for the enemies of the state. For example, death penalty for terrorists, of course, Arab terrorists, because in the far-right discourse, there is no alternative definitions of terrorism. There is no such thing as Jewish terrorism or settler terrorism. And he himself was also convicted of supporting terrorism. Despite his, he promoted this idea of harsher punishment, so death penalty for terrorists or the life imprisonment for them. And this call also includes banning Arab leaders from the Knesset on the grounds that they are operating against the state and supposedly supporting terrorists. Offers to expel them from the Knesset. And in the second election period, he went even further by calling the banishment of Arab leaders, key Arab leaders from the country. Another component of this demand is strengthening security forces by easing the use of force regulations. For example, the open fire instructions. According to Ben-Gvir, the open fire instructions undermine the capacity of the security forces in dealing with protesters, rioters, and terrorists. All these different words were used by him to call for strengthening security forces. I call it selective or ethno-national reinterpretation because both leaders, they do not support such harsh measures against against settlers, for example, even though some of them involved in violent attacks against Palestinians. In some cases, they did the opposite. They criticized these measures taken against settlers, even if they involved violence, some sort of violence against the military, for example. Before, ahead of 2022 elections, there were confrontations between the police and the Palestinians or the military and the settlers. And in both cases, we see the act of throwing a stone. But when defining the stone throwers in confrontations with the security forces, the identity of the perpetrator always mattered when calling for action. And not independent from the legal political establishment, self-positioning is also pretty much illustrative. And it has two main opposite calls. The first is the positive call. I define it as consolidatory politics. And the negative call, I define it as anti-politics. If I start with anti-politics, we see three aspects and all related to the legitimacy seeking of the alliance because of Otzmeh Yehudit. The self-legitimacy seeking led to delegitimizing others. So the first aspect is delegitimizing Arab member of Knesset and Palestinians in the streets of Jerusalem and in the villages of the West Bank. They were supposedly, they were portrayed as enemies of the state. The second aspect is demonizing the left and the liberals on the grounds that these actors were emphasizing the illegitimate character of Kahanism or legitimacy. They emphasized the legitimacy of Otzmeh Yehudit. And the third aspect is demonizing the right-wing actors because especially before 2021 elections, some of the right-wing actors were reluctant to cooperate with Netanyahu and the right-wing. And so they were accused of stealing the right-wing votes to form non-right government against the Jewish state. So they were seen as traitors. While the first two aspects of this negative call was exclusively constructed by Ben-Gvir. The third was initially constructed by Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. And the positive call includes two aspects as well. The first is consolidation of the religious Zionist camp, because especially especially in the first election period, there were two religious Zionist parties competing with each other. So it was the strategy of religious Zionism to consolidate national religious voice, to mobilize those people and portray these values and promote religious Zionism list as the true representative of this camp. So there was an intra-camp rivalry in this period. I call it the positive call. And the second positive direction was the secretization of the writing religion. So it was about the self-portrait again, because religious Zionism camp or the religious Zionism party portrayed itself as the guarantor of the establishment of a young right-wing government, but not right-wing in name, but right-wing in essence. So it portrayed itself as the guarantor of the establishment of Yamin Amiti, the real right. This is, as I said, the general framework that was created after the round of coding. The second round of coding, after providing this broad framework that I mapped out, let's dive into the details with some examples. These are two questions. The first is showing the coding frequency, and the second is division of labor. So as seen in the graphs, a clear division of labor between actors. And in the 2021 elections, four aspects dominated the general discourse of the alliance. The most dominant two are pro-settlement language and the call for judicial reform, and they were mainly constructed by Smotrich. And the third and the fourth dominant themes were constructed mainly by Ben-Gvir, which are ethno-national, the call for ethno-national reinterpretation of law for the sake of the state of state, both physical and ontological security, and also the organization of the situation in the Negev and the call for de facto sovereignty. Given the fact that both actors are settlers, it's not surprising to see the prominence of this pro-settlement language. Smotrich lives in Kedumim, Ben-Gvir lives in Gitar, so they are both settlers. And historically, there is a harmonious relationship between religious Zionism movement and the settlement enterprise formation of Gush Eminim and later the Yesha Council, which is the umbrella organization for the regional and local councils and city mayors. And the settler population is also seen as one of the main voting bases of the religious Zionism movement. For example, in the 2021 elections, religious Zionism gained, it became the most popular party in the settlements. It gained 21% of votes in the settlements, but the overall percentage of votes it gained nationwide was only 5%. Or another religious Zionist party, Yamina, gained 13% of votes in the settlements, but it gained only 6% of votes nationwide. So a huge gap between the percentage of votes in settlements and nationwide showed the close relationship between religious Zionism and settlement enterprise. And the leaders of religious Zionist parties, both they have careers in pro-settlement organizations. The head of Yamina, Naftali Bennett, he served as a chairman of the Yesha Council before entering the politics. Bezalel Smotrich, he is one of the co-founders and leading figures of the movement. It's the organization, pro-settlement organization, that is monitoring the activities of the Palestinian Authority in the Area C, and it defines activities as illegal activities or land grabbing. So it puts itself as the antithesis of the peace movement, Peace Now, because Peace Now also monitors the illegal settlement activities in the West Bank. In Smotrich's discourse, settlement language is listed one of the national religious values. So he claims that he strictly committed to these values, and his discursive consistency made pro-settlement language as the dominant theme in the of the far-right alliance in 2021. And his emphasis on settlements was accompanied by the call for judicial reform. The coherence of these two themes reflects two types of alignment. First, judicial reform or judicial system is portrayed as an obstacle for the expansion of settlements. So judicial reform is depicted as a necessary step to be taken. Or alternatively, settlement orientedness and judicial reform are listed as the core party values or the values of the right-wing coalition. And this example shows the second alignment. He portrays the core values of the right-wing coalition, being right-wing in Jewish identity, being right-wing in love, being right-wing in settlement, being right-wing in sovereignty, governance, so on and so forth. So considering this, it's not surprising to see the call for judicial reform was the second most quoted element in the far-right discourse. And regarding self-positioning, the collection of these points can be understood as the efforts to consolidate religious Zionist camp and to securitize right-wing government. So pro-settlement language in the first elections had positive connotations. It was supported by positive calls, the consolidatory language. But this was mainly constructed by Smotrich, not Ben-Gvir. Ben-Gvir's contribution this process was quite limited, although it was not entirely absent. In the 2022 elections, the influence of Ben-Gvir increased to shape the directions of the alliance, even though settlement orientedness remained remained at the core of the discourse. The connotations of pro-settlement language radically changed. And unlike the first elections, Ben-Gvir also played a significant role in shaping the language of settlements. Almost 40% of posts were produced by Ben-Gvir. And in terms of co-occurrence, there is almost no clear connection with topics of the legal political establishment. And regarding self-positioning, the positive call disappeared, and half of the settlement-related post targeted Arabs, directly or indirectly. So anti-Arab discourse accompanied the pro-settlement language. One thing that might explain this shift can be the outbreak of the violence that erupted in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem, then spread to other cities in Israel and to the West Bank. But actually, this anti-language was already evident in the discourse of Ben-Gvir, but it became clearer and more intense for actors in the West. Smotrich also started to use this anti-rhetoric to frame his position regarding the settlements. In this example, Smotrich is raising criticism against the government, particularly in defense of settlers in the West Bank, even if they were in violence against Palestinians, while calling Arabs as terrorists because they were throwing stones. He condemned the government for not sending border police to confront with the Palestinians, but instead to stop the settler violence in the West Bank town of Wara, and he promised that they would replace them. He would replace the prime minister, and they really did it. After 2022 elections, Smotrich held the ministerial position within the defense ministry with some responsibilities over the settlements, and Ben-Gvir became the minister of national security and control the police forces. I take this example because just a couple of months later, the conflict escalated in Huwara, and after two settlers were shot dead by a Palestinian gunman, settlers stormed villages around Huwara, and the Israeli major general who was responsible for the area was pogrom. And after the events, Smotrich commented that the village of Huwara needed to be wiped out. So I wanted to show this example of settlement orientedness or settlement related post had different connotations from the first elections. In terms of self-positioning, I have noticed a significant shift between elections. When the consolidation of the religious Zionist camp was more prominent in the first elections, the anti-Arab rhetoric became the central pillar of the alliance. There could be certain reasons explaining this. The first is, I just mentioned, the violence occurred between these elections, specifically the May 2021 violence. Another reason can be the short-lived anti-Netanyahu government, including an Arab party, which did not create but crystallized the demonization of Arabs in politics. The third is the lack of intra-camp rivalry, because in 2021 elections, two religious parties were competing with each other, but in 2022 elections, religious Zionism remained as the sole former representative of religious Zionism. So the lack of this kind of rivalry put the consolidation discourse on the back burner. And the last reason, I think one of the most important one, is the increasing influence of Benjamin. Almost 7% of posts, anti-Arab related posts, were produced by him. So we see struggle of Ben-Gvir to promote himself as a legitimate actor in politics, because he was portrayed as supremacist and a supporter of terrorism. To counter these accusations, he developed a counter discourse, the reverse the language of legitimacy, and instead attacked the legitimacy of others. And Arabs became his primary targets. The left-hand liberal alliance was demonized for emphasizing Ben-Gvir's illegitimacy and allegedly cooperating with Arabs. Right-wing actors who attacked the legitimacy of Osman Yehudit were also attacked by Ben-Gvir during the period, within the strategy of the seek of self-legitimacy. The logic is quite simple. I'm illegitimate in the eyes of illegitimates. That makes me legitimate. So there are plenty of examples of this. If we are inside, they're outside. I'm seen illegitimate. I'm portrayed as illegitimate by those who see Ahmed Tibi or Yitzhak Yitzhak. So if we are inside, Meretz outside. Don't like Lapid? Come and join us. But when it comes to the Arabs, it goes even further and calls for the banishment of the Arab leaders from the country. Even though it was not a realistic demand or an actual action, it shows the intensity of this anti-language. If we examine the co-occurrence of the anti-Arab component in Ben-Gvir's discourse in detail, we can see how it goes hand in hand with the call for national layoff. It means whenever he speaks about Arabs, he calls for action against them. He calls for legal action against them. This pattern was already evident in the previous examples, like if we are inside, Meretz outside. But when it comes to Arabs, he supports the measures taken against them to prohibit them from running in the Knesset or to prevent the Supreme Court from overturning the disqualification decisions about the Arab leaders that was taken by Central Election Committee. And there are four examples of the occurrence between anti-Arab discourse and a national reinterpretation of law. The first is, as I already mentioned, the exclusion of key Arab leaders and politicians. For example, he's not happy when Supreme Court vilifies the disqualification decisions taken by the Central Election Committee. The second is advocating for punishment for Palestinians in the streets or Palestinians involved in violence against Jews, especially in the West Bank, and also the protesters against the security forces. So you see the examples of these two. The third is using force regulations, which are supposedly restraining the security forces in dealing with the Arabs, Arab protesters, rioters, or terrorists, as I said before. Different words were used by him. The fourth concerns the armament of individuals. Of course, not the citizens, armament of citizens, but not the Arab citizens, obviously. So it's not uncommon to see him in the streets. In this particular example, during the election campaign period, he was photographed confronting Palestinians whom he labeled as terrorists because they were throwing stones at him. And the next day, he shared a post with a picture with his kids in the playground. He took them to a playground and they are seen as holding toy weapons and shooting. So Ben-Gvir proudly stating that he's teaching his kids how to deal with the terrorists. So one of the first actions he did after October 7th was to authorize the release of weapons. To conclude my talk, I can say that the clear, what I found in this research, there was a clear division of labor in this partnership, aligned with their independent political orientations. While their priorities diverged, they didn't clash in the prioritized topics. Smotrich was more active in the first elections, and his priorities and formations were more prominent within the alliance. But in the second elections, Ben-Gvir took control of the discursive directions of the alliance. While the first elections, negative discourse in Salvation was visibly constructed by Ben-Gvir, second elections, Smotrich came closer to this anti-language in framing his position in other topics. I stop here. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Okay, I'll thank you very much. I'll stop recording, and the floor is open for questions.